Chula Vista, California, as our case study. Okay. Our first speaker is Steve Castaneda. He's a council person in Chula Vista. He's going to set the stage by explaining the types of healthy environmental change work that's actually going on right now in Chula Vista, and he's going to tell us all why he and others on the city council were interested in pursuing this. And they've been a healthy eating active community site for how many years now? 5 years. Okay, so they're one of the pioneers in the state of California. And they've actually done a lot to start to build a healthier environment in Chula Vista, which is San Diego County, for those of you who don't remember your California geography or who didn't grow up in California. We're then going to follow on with Dana Richardson. Dana is active in Chula Vista, and he is going to tell about his organization and what they've done, how they've worked with local elected officials, how they've worked with technical assistance providers like my organization and others, funders like the California Endowment, which has done a lot through their Healthy Eating Active Communities program to help foster some of this work at the local level and to bring technical assistance knowledge down to the local level to help make environmental change, healthy environmental change. From Dana, then to one of my colleagues, Heather Wooten, who's also at Public Health Law and Policy, and she has been at Public Health Law and Policy longer than I have and has been working closely with Chula Vista and others around the state to really give people the kind of technical assistance that they need in order to get their work done. So she's going to talk about that and the type of technical assistance that's available to communities like yours, because, you know, not everyone might have their finger on the latest planning policy language or for food or whatever, you know, some of the other people around the state are doing. And as technical assistance providers, we can help bring you some of the lessons and help distill some of the best practices so that you can learn from what Chula Vista and others have done for the last 5 years and get a real jump start on your work. And then Manal Abalada is going to finish up. She's going to be the last speaker, and she's going to talk broadly about the types of resources that are available through the California Convergence and through some of the other initiatives that are going on around the state right now where people are working to build healthy communities. We all know that everyone is financially strapped and that in a lot of people's minds that really poses a challenge when you're talking about changing the ways you're doing business. But we're going to talk to you about some of the resources that are available for you to help you do the work. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to give everyone about 10 minutes. That's 10, that's 40. We've got till 2:30, so then we're going to engage in conversation. Everyone was supposed to give me questions to ask them, but most of them didn't, so I'm just going to come up with my own questions to get them going. And then I see two microphones, and I haven't tested them, but I assume they work. And so we'll open the field to questions as well, because you've been sitting here for a long time and I'd like you to be able to get up and be active, okay? So we're going to start off with Council Member Castaneda. So one thing I'd like him to explain to us is how the Chula Vista Little League team managed to win the Little League World Series.
Thank you.
You know what I have to say, I'm not sure how they did it. I'm just glad they did. And, you know, I went to the head of our Chamber of Commerce, and obviously for everyone that's involved in government, we know what's happening with budgets. And I think many of you in the past, and maybe you still do, have given money, you know, to the Chambers of Commerce, and if you have a Convention and Visitors Bureau, to go out and to promote the city, to basically raise the awareness not only in the region but the state and the country about what your city's doing and all the great things if you have a little bit of a desire to be in the tourism business, which we do obviously in Chula Vista since we're close to the water. And I went to the head of the Chamber of Commerce and I said, you know, the way that I look at it is the last 10 years we've given you about $5 million, and these 12 young men in 1 week did more to promote the city of Chula Vista with basically, you know, just their parents and, you know, the neighborhoods supporting their team. And, you know, we've got so much exposure. And, you know, the kids, I don't know that it's been set, but they've been invited to the White House. And they've become the celebrities. They are clearly the cream of the crop in Chula Vista, and we're very proud. We're very happy that they've gotten so much support from around the country. But let's talk a little bit about specifically about Chula Vista, because many of you may not know a lot about Chula Vista. You know, we are in the county of San Diego. We're the county of San Diego, second largest city. You know, big brother is San Diego. And we rest just south of the city of San Diego and about 8 miles north of the Mexican-U.S. border. And obviously, being that close to the U.S.-Mexican border has a lot of opportunities. It's got a lot of benefits, but it's also got a lot of challenges. We obviously are having, you know, a little bit of an issue with some of the well-publicized wars going on with the cartels and so forth, and a bit of that sometimes spills into our community. And, you know, our police department and our other law enforcement agencies struggle with that. But all in all, the communities of Chula Vista are very strong. We really don't have the challenges that a lot of inner city communities do, and that's translated to some things that are actually quite good for healthy eating and active communities. And it's very, I think, very good for me to come to speak to a group, and I speak to a few groups here and there around the state about this particular issue, of all city elected and appointed personnel, because a lot of times when I go and I talk to folks in counties or school districts or so forth, they're doing a lot of things and they have a lot of background and a lot of understanding about health issues and about the need to be active in our communities, the challenges that our low income and our minority communities are having with the ability to make healthy choices. And we traditionally as cities have never been in that realm. But the good thing is that's changing. And it's changing because of good folks at HEAC, the California Endowment, and folks that really care about low-income and minority communities have sat down and said, we need to do something. And we can't just do it through the traditional modes of communication or governance, such as the counties, the states, and the school district. We really need cities to be involved. I just started my second term as a city council member in December. And since I have been on the city council, you know, Dana, who you're going to hear from in a couple of minutes, basically came with Tanya, who maybe some of you know that she's been very active in HEAC and Chula Vista, but also statewide, came and visited me and talked about wanting to get the city of Chula Vista involved in the healthy eating and active communities movement. And I sort of thought about it because I have a bit of a history in local government, particularly municipal government. I worked for the city of San Diego for a number of years. And I said, well, you know, isn't that sort of the county's job? And isn't that sort of the state's job and the school districts and all that? And they said, no, that whole paradigm is shifting. And we know that we have limited success when we go through the traditional methods. And so we really need Chula Vista to be our partner. So it didn't take a lot of convincing for me to understand that our communities, the Latino communities of Chula Vista, were directly impacted by the problems of obesity and diabetes and just a lack of opportunities to understand what healthy eating and being active really was and what the benefits were. And I know that, you know, Robert presented, I was at a bit of the symposium. He talked a lot about, you know, what local city governments can do. And so I started really looking at some of the things that we have that directly affect neighborhoods and how we can improve the quality of life by giving people better choices in terms of what they put in their mouth. And I started thinking about it, and the city has a lot of abilities. We have a significant amount of ability to steer public policy, to basically make land use changes, to insist that retailers and people that provide, you know, our communities with food make sane and make responsible decisions in terms of who they and what they sell. And so we started talking about some of the things that the city could do right off. And so they talked about, well, you know, you've got all these recreation centers and, you know, you go there and the vending machines have, you know, salted peanuts and they've got candies and they've got all this stuff. And these kids, it's really sort of you know, inconsistency, because you're asking them to be active in the recreation center, and then when they come out, and all they have is choices of bad food. So I said, okay, well, let's look at that. And so I brought our purchasing person in, and I said, you know, let's make some decisions on changing the vending products. And he said, no, we've got contracts, and we can't make any changes on that, and you know, we'll be sued and all this kind of stuff. And I didn't believe that. So I talked to a few of my colleagues, and, you know, we brought it to the city council. We told the city manager, this is where we're going. You guys, you and the city attorney, figure it out, because this is where we're going. It was a 4-1 vote. We have 5 members on the city council. And one fella basically argued the fact that it was some sort of constitutional right to be able to buy a Snickers bar in a Chula Vista Recreation Center. You know, rather than engage in that sort of discourse, we just decided to live with the 4-1. Basically today, you know, the vending policy in Chula Vista is something that has been copied and emulated in cities all over California. And so that was just a very small step. What we really wanted to do was move forward on more public policy matters. And we looked at, and we did, we banned smoking and outdoor eating. Eating areas, we banned smoking, you know, 50 feet around the openings of buildings. We had a lactation policy for our city buildings that set aside room for mothers that wanted to breastfeed. And so we started to do a lot of those things. And those were things that really cities didn't previously do. Then I started to think about, okay, well, how do we go out not only in city facilities and these things, and how I'm going to the community and basically do things to insist that, you know, that people in neighborhoods have access. So we started looking at the western part of Chula Vista, which is predominantly Latino, and we hadn't built any parks there. So we started looking at and getting federal funds and using city money and started dedicating and prioritizing these neighborhoods. So we built a couple of new parks, and we got a couple more that are coming on. And we started to get the police sort of interested in what's happening with making sure that our streets are a little bit safer, that we have a little bit more visibility and more presence in areas around parks, because mothers and kids were a little concerned about some of the elements in hanging some of these parks. So we really tried to make the neighborhood a little bit more user-friendly. The next thing that we're doing, and we are actually doing a specific plan for our whole southwest part, which is probably about 85% Latino, southwest part of the community, and it will actually be one of the first planning documents that will have a health benefit index, in that we will ensure that we have the kinds of facilities and the kinds of amenities that basically promote healthy living and active communities, and basically, you know, put an end to drive-through fast foods. Use our redevelopment dollars, and I know that you talked about redevelopment. Basically, use our redevelopment dollars to say to people that want to use city funds, taxpayer funds, to build buildings, that you will not lease or sell to folks that are basically going to sell unhealthy foods. We can do those things. And those things have never been thought of. Usually, all of us are city officials of one sort or another. We usually think about building heights and FARs and parking spaces and, you know, driveways and ADTs and all those things. But we never think about, you know, what we're actually doing in the store and what's that doing to the community as a whole. So that's a whole new way of looking. And we're basically working with HEAC. And again, Dana's going to talk a lot about what those activities are, but HEAC really has been the lightning rod behind what Chula Vista is doing. I frankly would have never thought about doing half of this stuff, but they get you in there and they start to make you understand how you can make change that really does affect people. I want to talk a little bit about something also, because our city is a fairly safe community, And I know that a lot of inner city communities, and Robert talked about that, where you have an emerging community where big time retail grocers don't want to come in because they don't want to make that investment. They're worried about their assets and they're worried about their employees. Well, we don't really have that problem in Chula Vista. In southwestern Chula Vista, we had three major grocery stores. We had Albertsons, Ralph's, and Vaughn's. The problem is that those grocery stores have not been able to compete because the Latino neighborhoods want their products. And so what's happening is that the little neighborhood grocery stores are starting to see more business, and they're starting to see, a need and a demand for fresh fruits and vegetables. And so what's happened is the Vaughn's and the Albertsons and the Ralph's have moved out. We're starting to see these mid-sized retailers. Many of them are headquartered in Los Angeles, and I don't think there's a copyright issue here, but Gonzalez Marketplace is one. They owns about 35 stores. I met the president the other day because he had sponsored a big event for our World Series champions. And I got to talking about him and saying, hey, listen, I go to your store all the time. And I love the fruits and vegetables. I love the fresh fruits, or excuse me, the fresh meats and the poultry and the fish. I said, the problem is that there are other products that I think that people are health-minded want to buy. You're using non-fat, flavorless yogurt instead of sour cream. A lot of different, having more like a granolas and all those kinds of things like that. And he said, we've been struggling with that issue because we don't know whether or not the Latino communities will buy those. And I think Dana's going to share a little bit of information about what's going on in his community because he lives in National City just to the north of us. But quite frankly, with HEAC educating our neighborhoods about what healthy eating and healthy purchasing choices are, about basically the kids getting it from the schools, we are building the market for those kinds of food. And so my message to him was, you offer it and they will buy it. And the fact is he's agreed to start to set aside portions of his refrigerator counters to these kinds of foods. And so that's going to be tremendous because when we think about, about healthy eating or choices, we think about fresh fruits and meats. But you know what? Since we live so close to Mexico, some of the products that come from Mexico, my son bought some bag of Takis or something. I was from Mexico, and I looked at the nutritional information, and I would rather him eat a bag of Lay's Fritos or something, because this stuff has so much sodium and so much fat and all of these things, and really we have to sort of worry about that too. So, when I think about city government, I think about land use planning, but I think about the way that we can steer our community and we can build communities, particularly those that have been neglected in the past and ones we don't think about. And working with organizations like HEAC, the California Endowment, and other groups that are working to educate Latino and minority communities about what to eat and how to make those kinds of foods that are better for them, I think we are starting to make some headway in this regard. So I appreciate you listening to me. Thank you very much.
And you'll get the opportunity to hear from the councilman later on and to direct some questions in toward him. Dana, over to you, okay? In 10 minutes, please.
Can you say I just worked myself out of a job? I'm very appreciative of the opportunity to hear the council members so eloquently speak about sustainable leadership on this issue of food and physical activity environments. Thank you so much. I'm Dana Richardson. I represent an organization called Community Health Improvement Partners, which is the community benefit arm of the Healthcare Association of San Diego and Imperial Counties in San Diego. We have been working on built environment and public health issues since actually the late 90s, which you just heard is really like 15 years in the making. And I hope you indulge me in kind of this stream of consciousness in what I have to share with you, because the council member basically took everything out of my mind that I was going to say with you today. But the fact is that
that's because you taught me everything.
I just want to share with you another perspective, because getting to that place where sustainable leader in the community speak so eloquently about these issues and how he's actually attacked this obesity epidemic is what it's all about. And I guess I have one question. How many of us have bona fide partnerships with non-governmental organizations and resident groups in our cities? This is good, and it has to continue to grow, because you know that the cities, the school districts, they can't do it all alone. And we need to fortify our relationship, and non-governmental organizations like mine, they need to be relentless. I mean, this has been a 10, 15-year boxing match. Literally, I had to set so many meetings to get the council member Castaneda, his aide, the mayor. So many times there was an overhaul of high-level staff, elected officials, and I have to go back, re-educate, throw ideas out there, a la carte, packaged, however you want to see it. But this is just kind of like the story from a non-governmental, resident-led perspective. I'll tell you how this happened. Back in March 2005, I was at my first conference with the endowment in Santa Monica. And toward the end, the California Endowment put out a press release stating that they put $26 million into obesity prevention in one of six communities, and that was one of the six communities was Chula Vista. So I actually got a call from local San Diego Tribune, and she interviewed me, and I said all the right things, basically. But one thing I said was that parks could be unsafe. Do you know that put me a couple steps back in my relationship development with the city of Chula Vista? Well, even though I had a good feature story, I still was walking upward, and because I took a couple steps back with the way that I had stated myself, but what I stated was really real. And so beyond that, however, I took an opportunity to engage with another media outlet. Let's see, the KUSI Morning Show, and I had a live 15-minute interview with a producer there, and had all my talking points and everything. I talked about the same things about built environment and public health. I talked about statistics. And then my education process began from the perspective of a local city. I left that interview and I got several calls, and one was from one of the partner organizations called Environmental Health Coalition. Never thought that I would ever bond in a childhood obesity prevention effort with environmental activists. But the fact is that this lady, Linda, I can't remember her last name right now, but she educated me on the timeliness of the issue back in March 2005. You see, they were going through a general plan update, and this lady called me and she said, you know what, if you don't know the steps, I'll take you through them. And she actually had me meet with my talking points about built environment, public health, and strategies with all the council members and the mayor. And she also encouraged me to advocate through letters and get it to the principal planner who was overseeing the general plan update process. So I did a quick read of Public Health Law and Policy, Prevention Institute, California Center for Public Health Advocacy, and put together a pretty decent letter after some folks read through it. And I got to the guy that was a principal planner. His name was Ed Badshelter. Ed Badshelter ended up calling me. He said, I like what you have here. This looks good. I'm going to use the development of parks, pedestrian safety, lighting, sidewalks, access to farmers market, this fast food thing that you put in here, I'm not going to do. And that really just started the relationship. And what I say is that at times during this quest to really bond with them and build trust, I actually spoke on different topics that I didn't even get paid for to do. See, and that's what non-governmental organizations and local residents need to do. They have to be willing to set their agenda aside and then come and talk about tall buildings. Remember that discussion? You know, people were in the meeting about building heights, and they were missing the point of just how substantial the general plan update was, but people were willing to just be in a meeting till midnight to argue about the height of buildings. but they were, and they were missing the general point. So after that, we were able to gain quite a bit of notoriety, and our partnership is unique. From the perspective of the California Endowment, or rather my assessment, and the Public Health Institute and Kaiser, you know, they basically are looking for sustainable leadership, like what Steve has exemplified. They put our community-based organization in the room for 5 years with city employees, two school districts, and the public health department. And that was just to inspire what you see so eloquently demonstrated right here. And so with popularity came opportunity. And the timing was right. They were going through an update. They wanted to revitalize their downtown. They wanted to revitalize and upgrade the southwest area of Chula Vista and also their bayfront. And simultaneously, you see Councilmember Castaneda was also a NALEO fellow, National Association of Latino Elected Officials. And his one of his projects was around childhood obesity, but through improving food and physical activity environments. So we were able to talk quite regularly about what it is that we could do, strategies to implement, how could we move the needle on these things. And we've accomplished a lot. I'll go ahead and tell you some of it. The planning and transportation element, 7.16, talks about the farmers markets, sidewalks, the development of parks and open space. They have a 100% healthy vending policy citywide. There's a breastfeeding accommodations policy. They had the grand opening of a park, the first one on the west side of Chula Vista in 25 years. They revitalized, or rather enhanced conditions at three other parks. They improved school communities, sidewalks, walkability. But that's just scratching the surface. The leadership, as soon as the infrastructure was infiltrated, or rather infected, they went on and took it a step further. Do you know that they deemed four parks in Western Chula Vista as alcohol-free? They also talked about banning smoking in parks. And then they leveraged their relationship with HEAC, or rather the experience of the initiative to do city business. They got a $1.1 million Safe Routes to School grants. Those are two grants. Community-based transportation planning grant for $241,000, and also a $400,000 City of Chula Vista Brownfields grant. I say all of this to say that we've accomplished a lot, but we just scratched the surface. And what I'd like to talk to you more about during the session is, what about that neighborhood connection, that neighborhood apathy that exists? We know the cities can't do it all. We know school districts can't do it all. But when is the community going to get involved in proactively making change? I have a lot of ideas to share about that. I invite your conversation.
Thank you very much, Dana. Heather is going to speak next, specifically about the types of technical assistance that some of the technical assistance providers around the state can provide to both the city and to the community-based organization in the city to help them move some of this work forward.
Well, thank you, Robert, and I just have to say it's a real pleasure to share the table today with such amazing community leadership out of Chula Vista. For those of you who were in the session immediately preceding this, Robert probably talked a little bit about our SHOT, but I'll just do a quick recap so that people know what we mean when we talk about technical assistance. So Robert and I both work for an organization called Public Health Law and Policy, and we're a team of mostly lawyers, a sprinkling of city planners. I am one of the city planning minority in the office, and a few public policy experts. And our job is to work with communities around California, around the country, to help them understand how legal and policy tools can be used to support healthy communities. So we're kind of like the planning expert, legal expert backup that communities can call when they have an idea, they don't necessarily know what the tools would be to execute that idea, or they want to just become fluent in understanding the tools so that they can be competent advocates when they go to their city council, when they go to their decision makers in their community. So I really appreciated what Dana was talking about when he said, you know, this is all about the road that gets us to these success stories, because technical assistance, I think, is a really critical part of that road. And what I see my role is in communities is being able to listen to how they describe their interests and needs and provide them with resources that let them do their job better. So whether that job is you know, having a meeting with their head of the city planning department and convincing that person to include policy language in a general plan, whether it's meeting with their council member and talking about, you know, restructuring contracting around vending, that is something that we're trying to help them do more effectively. And one of the things that I think we try and get out there and let people know about is that if you're thinking about undertaking a policy process to support healthy communities, you know, what time do you pick up the phone and call your technical assistance expert, you know, your outsider, and ask them for help with your project? And, you know, the short answer to that is really at any time in the process. You should be thinking about how you could maybe reach out to resources that are available on these topics of healthy eating and active living. So we've worked with communities at all stages of the process. In the very early stages, it might be a phone call with somebody about something like, hey, we're interested in getting involved in our general plan. What's the process of doing that? And I think it was so funny that Dana talked about this story. So I started working at Public Health Law and Policy in 2006. The story he described where he was going and making all those meetings and sending all those letters was 2005. By the time I started working, I called up Dana. I was like, hey, how did you do that in Chula Vista, Dana? And he was the expert. He knew, you know, the most effective strategy for doing this. So it's, by the way, a really iterative process. We learn as much from the communities as we, you know, try and pass on in terms of, you know, technical skills or technical knowledge. So if it's really early in the process, one of the things that we might do is do a policy scan from, you know, around the state or around the country about what communities have adopted similar things. And an example of that recently was that one of the advocates who both these folks I mentioned earlier, Tanya, was looking for policies that support something called crime prevention through environmental design. And crime prevention through environmental design is a sort of state of planning practice that looks at how the way we design communities impacts people's own personal feelings of safety, as well as the likelihood that crime will occur in communities. And it looks at things like lighting and transparency and ability to see into certain areas, as well as just other kinds of design things to think through, you know, are there things that we can do at a planning level to actually impact whether people feel safe in their neighborhoods and whether criminals think that this is an okay place to be, you know, hanging out. So we did a scan of policies from around the country and provided her with some examples that she was able to then take back and say, oh, okay, so this is a range of options we might think through if we're going to go down this type of path in Chula Vista. We also have come in at the 11th hour, at the very last moment of a policy process. And actually, I've had a number of examples of working with communities on general plans that's happened, which is not ideal. Ideally, you're always in there at the ground floor if you're an advocate. But one of the things that I think technical assistance can help you with if you get in at the 11th hour is crafting your comments or your response or your advocacy or your, you know, your agenda, your campaign in such a way that it's as effective as possible, so that you have a very clear ask, so that what you're asking for is within the legal and policy structure that it's trying to fit into, so that you have the best chance of basically getting something in, even though it is at the last minute, without causing a lot of, you know, slowdowns or resentment or complications. And we've been able to do that with a number of communities around the country as well. And then there are also examples of getting in at the midway stage. And the midway stage might be you're looking to, let's say, pass a community gardening policy at the local level. And you want to have someone review that policy and see, hey, are there ways that this policy could be strengthened? Are we thinking through everything we should be thinking of? You know, just is there someone out there who could take a look at this and, you know, from their perspective, provide some feedback? And that was another example of a project we just worked on in Chula Vista where they were passing a city policy for support of community gardens. It's a great policy. I think it's an excellent example for the state of California. And we were able to review and with our own expertise of other communities, provide some insight and maybe ask some kind of questions that those advocates can then bring and engage their elected officials on. So, you know, the message that I would say is the earlier the better. That's always the story. But if you're thinking about going through a policy process and you feel like it would be useful to have technical assistance, there's never a bad time to pick up the phone or send an email and get that resource. And then the other issue that I wanted to talk about, because I think this is a really two minutes, I'm going to talk about what it means to be an outside technical assistance provider and respond to the diversity of political climates in communities, you know, which we see even in California. We're a very diverse state politically, and especially for Robert and I, as folks who operate out of the Bay Area, I think we bring a lot of unfortunate Berkeleyite baggage that comes with us, San Francisco baggage that comes with us. And it's, you know, it's a reality that we try and deal with, but also dismiss to some extent when we're actually working with communities. We work in a really diverse range of communities, and I just want to emphasize for everybody in the room, the leaders in this movement, I don't think are the usual suspects. I think the leading communities who are doing some of the best work around the state of California and even around the country on these topics are places like, you know, Louisville, Kentucky, places like Chula Vista, California, places like Delano, California, Richmond, California. You know, these are not the places that have all the resources and, you know, all the talent and all of this and all of that. They're places with really committed community organizations, with, I think, leadership that is able to see the importance of this issue to their community and who are able to get things done. And I think that's really the most critical piece of this. And I'll say for me, as a technical assistance provider, you know, I do have an agenda. My agenda is to get the best policy for that place in passed and on the books. And that means responding to the specific political climate in which I'm working. And I think, you know, Dana's example talking about fast food is a great one. This is a topic I often bring up with advocates. You know, are you interested in restricting fast food in your community? Here are the tools you can use to do it. Now, whether those tools are politically feasible to be used is something that varies. But one of the things that we try and do is help advocates understand that if they're pitching their policy from a health or childhood obesity perspective, there may be other ways to pitch that policy to folks who don't necessarily respond to that as strongly. So when you're thinking about something like fast food, the big issue for a lot of places, and this is going to be probably true with all business issues, is, you know, the tax base. And communities are really concerned about saying no to any business these days, I'd say, in this political climate, this economic climate. And the idea that you'd be restricting any kind of business may not be politically popular. So we try and help communities think through, okay, well, what's the flip side of this? Can you focus on healthy food businesses as an economic development strategy? Think about job creation, tax base, economic development, for healthy businesses, and not just say, no, we're saying no to business, and that's the strategy that we're going after. So I think that's just something important to keep in mind. So I will, I think, pause now, since I see Robert standing, which is always a sign to move on, and pass it to Manal. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Heather. Manal Abulata is here from the Prevention Institute, and resources are critical. Resources in terms of knowledge, in terms of support, in terms of being part of a movement, in terms of learning how to get access to technical assistance. So I'm going to turn the floor over to Manal to talk about the sort of resources that are available in the state, because California really is in the forefront of making these sort of healthy built environment changes.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. When Robert called me and asked me if I wanted to come speak to the league, I said I would be absolutely honored to do that. What do you want me to talk about? And he said, resources in California. And I said, no, I'm not going to do it. The state was talking about IOUs, our colleagues in the state and in around the city were going and facing furlough days. And when I think about resources, I think about money to do the things I want to do. So I told him, no way, let's think about a different topic. And he said, well, Manal, I really, the panel's been constructed, but let me negotiate with you. How about resources, and I'll put in parentheses, broadly construed, and you can talk about any kind of resources that you want to. So I decided I would do it because I do think it's an important issue, and because I do really acknowledge that we have a wealth of resources in our state that include financial resources but really do go beyond that. So I will be talking a little bit about some of those non-financial resources that I think are available to support work in healthy communities, healthy eating, active living communities, as well as some of the people and political kind of capital type of resources that I think are available. And I'll talk also about sort of what is currently on the ground in terms of resources, what I think is in the pipeline, and some things that we've heard maybe coming over the horizon, so we can talk in a little bit about, you know, three time phases. And then we'll really welcome some questions. So let me just start out with a question for you. There, one of the things that's been mentioned here is a Healthy Eating Active Communities Initiative, but there are a number of other types of initiatives like the California Convergence Initiative, which really represents six major funders in California nationally, representing 40 different sites throughout California. And California Endowment has just announced a very powerful initiative called Building Healthy Communities, where they've funded 14 communities in California, and they've conceptualized this as a 10-year initiative where communities will really build and work sustainably towards the kind of change that Dana and Councilmember Castaneda spoke of. How many people know for sure whether or not, yes or no, whether or not you have a Healthy Eating Active Communities or California Convergence or Robert Wood Johnson funded Healthy Eating Active Living by Design initiative in your city or local jurisdiction? Please, by a show of hands. So just to quote Dana, that's good, but it needs to continue. I really would like to see that every single person in this room is able to tell, say definitively, whether or not there is some local active collaborative working on eating and activity for two reasons. One, in this work, building healthy eating active communities, people in the public health field are needing to step out of their comfort zone. They're needing to understand how to talk about planning and understand why building heights might not be the central focus of the conversation. And they really require you in local government to navigate and help provide the leadership and say, this is some of the things we think we can do, this is some of the things we think we can't do, and to be able to come to you and ask, hey, we're thinking about trying to do something like healthy vending. What can you do? How can you help me? And I, just having worked with a number of communities that are funded through the endowment, through these other initiatives in the Convergence Partnership, there's a tremendous amount of knowledge and people power there, but the work of folks like you in the league can provide sustainability and depth and visibility to bring that work to the next level. And so I feel like it's very important in terms of the resources that have already hit the ground, people working in those convergence communities, HEAC communities, and so on, that they're connected to folks like you in local government. When Linda Schack, my colleague sitting over there, and I worked with NALEO, the National Association of Local Electeds, on their California Health, the National Health Leadership Program that they have, we were really struck by the fact that the local electeds that we were working with felt like they also wanted to be connected to the local collaboratives that were in their communities but didn't know how to. And so what we've really been trying to do since we understood that is try to really weave together and find connections and build connections. So we and a number of our partners are really available to local officials to figure out whether or not there's a funded community that's working on change, healthy eating, active living, change in your community, and trying to bridge those connections. And there's a number of other organizations that are doing that as well. So leaving here as sort of a bit of homework, I really encourage you to look and Google your city and find out if there's a Healthy Eating Active Communities Collaborative, a HEAL Collaborative, a California Convergence Collaborative, and we at Prevention Institute, or PHLP, I'm sure would be happy to do that. And so, you know, again, in thinking about resources, our human capital, you know, those of you who are in this room really clearly represent a key piece of the resources, because it is you and your ideas and your creativity that can leverage and make some of these ideas become a reality. Because no matter how much a person like me working in my neighborhood or a person working at the community or neighborhood level says we want a new park that's safe or we want complete streets, ultimately, we will need to work closely with you and decision makers like you to make that a reality. And one of the things, as I said, that community residents can bring is some of that people power. And I'm sure Dana will speak more to that. In terms of resources, because this work isn't completely intuitive and it's not easy, just building on Heather and Robert's conversation about sort of technical assistance and skills and training that are available, I think there are important organizations like the Institute for Local Government that are here to support your training and your skills and development. And in particular, I see there's a handout that was on your table at lunch really highlighting the League's Healthy Eating Active Living Initiative, which brings the expertise of the California Center for Public Health Advocacy and cities, counties, and schools. And Francesca and Charlotte, I believe you're in the room and maybe people have heard you. Stan, Francesca, that wasn't nearly visible enough. And she really, excellent, provides, I think, a lot of the technical and policy resources and understands deeply what cities, counties, and schools go through and need to think about in this kind of work. In addition to that, Naleo has been mentioned a number of times, and I think they have a Health Leadership Institute that I think not only is about training people, but what I saw in Steve's cohort was building a peer network of people that are thinking broadly about these issues, how do they do it, and I'm quite sure that other council members and school board members were able to call up Steve easily through that process and say, how do we do this? I'm feeling isolated, because there's no matter how much training you get, at the end of the day on Monday, you go back to your city or your county and stuff's the same, unless, you know, there's a process of change underway that either you're stimulating or that people are supportive of. And so having that peer network seems very important. The California Endowment, because of their ongoing commitment to healthy eating and active communities and now building healthy communities, has established a Health Exchange Academy. And that's an ongoing resource for training that's available to folks like you, other grantees of their work. And two of my favorite trainings, I think, that are very valuable to local officials, one of them is on media advocacy. When the media speaks to you and asks you a question and you need to speak on behalf of your jurisdiction, how can you do it in such a way that you focus on the policy? Hold on, let me do a time check. Okay. People respond to Robert standing up, but I always check myself. So that's really important. So moving along, I want to go to the financial resources that I think are very important for us to know about. One, at the federal level, how many people have a Recovery Act project going on in your community that you know of? So obviously the Recovery Act was a drop in the bucket compared to the federal resources that come here, but we would have liked to see that those dollars really be used to support infrastructure that supported healthy eating and active living. And on the off chance that there's a second recovery that comes, and we heard from someone at the state task force that they think there's a possibility of that, we think there's a real opportunity to think very creatively about infrastructure projects that can also support things like walking, biking, and so on. But in California, there's actually apparently $1 billion that has not been spent yet, and there appears to be some opportunity at the state level to advocate for maybe that being spent in ways that can support some of these. But that's a little bit more distal. I think that there's a couple other things just to share with you. Today, the federal government, Health and Human Services, announced their funding of $1 billion in an initiative called Putting Prevention to Work. Communities Putting Prevention to Work. And that $1 billion is going to go, it's a out of that $1 billion, $650 million is for community prevention and wellness. So the kinds of things that we've been talking here today are going to go out in a competitive grant program, $363 million in a competitive grants to communities. And there is a deadline for that competitive grant process on December 1st. So if any of you don't have plans for Thanksgiving, you should plan to write a grant for your local community. And then the other one-third of that money is going to go for states, territories, and other organizations to support that kind of work. And then there's two opportunities that I would say are on the horizon at the federal level. Transportation reauthorization is something that we typically think about in terms of roads, bridges, and so on. But increasingly, health advocates are getting into the mix and saying that transportation dollars can be used to put our fair share towards things like walkable, bikeable communities and the gentleman, as he called, complete streets. And those kind of strategies need not only just health advocates there at the table, but folks from the cities really advocating and representing the needs of their community so that that money comes from the federal to the state and down to the local level. And that will be postponed for 18 months. It was supposed to come up in the fall, but it'll probably not happen because of all the attention to health reform. And then child nutrition reauthorization is another huge federal bill that dictates resources coming federally to the state and then to locals as well to support food programs. But in recent years, in the last reauthorization in 2004, we saw that we could make big strides in how that money is spent locally to support more healthy food projects. I would just like to also say in the state, we have Prop 84 funds. That was the only, it was a voter-approved initiative for safe water, but there was a big chunk of that money for sustainable community strategies. And at the state level, the Strategic Growth Council just developed criteria for the first $12 million of that, those dollars, full pot of $90 million. And that's going to MPOs, but you'll be happy to know that Steve Sanders and Bill Higgins are there looking to make sure that the next $78 million comes down to the cities so that they're able to implement the kinds of sustainable community strategies that we've been talking about. And what we'd like to see from you is a little bit more of a marrying of the kinds of strategies that represent reducing vehicle miles traveled with things like transit, oriented development, and walking and biking and so on. And Robert, I think, already did an excellent job talking about the local resources, so I won't have to talk about that at all. Thank you.
I only stood up because I knew she was finished. So we've got some live mics. I would love to hear from people directed questions. I want to start one off straight to the councilman, which is I'm fairly certain that you didn't run for election initially saying you were going to make Chula Vista healthier.
No.
And so I want to know how you explain or sell or bring your electorate along so that they understand what's going on and why they should reelect you based on this.
Robert, thank you. No, I didn't. I ran much like everybody who's an elected official here did. I was going to reduce crime and reduce traffic and make the world otherwise a great place, you know, the city of Chula Vista a great place to live. And I guess I just had a better, you know, spiel than the other guy, but anyway, no, I didn't, and really it wasn't something that, you know, and I don't know how many communities it really is a bread and butter issue to. I mean, if you look at it from a wholly political spectrum, I'm going to be quite frankly, I don't know that it's actually going to make or break your political career. But the fact is there's just certain things, and we all know this in our job, these are just certain things that are just the right thing to do, and it feels good. I mean, how many people here are elected city officials? Because I know that we got some managers and so forth. How many people here are part-time city council members or mayors? Okay, so we've got a good, you know, I mean, really, I'm a part-time city council member. I have another job. I have things to do. I've got a family, obviously. I need to, you know, spend some time at City Hall, but I need to spend time other places. So my time is limited. So quite frankly, you know, HEAC and the folks that are out there, like we've just been hearing about, they're the ones that are the rubber to the road. And what really it is, in the minority communities, a lot of time Latinos don't come to City Hall and say we want healthy eating opportunities or we want access to parks and so forth. A lot of times Latinos just stay home and they grumble to themselves and so forth. These are the folks that get out there and start to light a fire in the neighborhood. And you know what? When people show up, and even when they don't, sometimes you just have to do things because it's the right thing to do. And you know, again, it isn't, I don't think it's, you know, at least in our community, it's not something that's going to break, make or break a political career, but quite frankly, it, what is important to make or break a real city and a healthy city, so.
So anyone with a question, I'm going to ask to go and stand behind the mic. So we've got two people, and I will start on the left because you were there first. Oh, Dana has a rejoinder. Excuse me, sir. Quickly.
Hello? Okay. I mean, what was so crazy is that council member and I don't spend a lot of time together, especially recently, because we're just struggling to survive and keep the effort going. But a lot of what we're thinking is in lockstep, and I just feel so blessed. And, you know, what I didn't say earlier was that you got to have a councilman as a champ. You have to have physicians as a champ. And you have to use your stakeholders in really strategic ways because people, you know, listen to these authorities. And one of the things that he did was whatever he was referring from the diets around healthy eating and activity, it didn't fit with the way that the city operated. It just didn't. But he did the referral from the diets, and he said, meet with these people and go figure it out and translate it for our system. And that's a huge thing that a lot of elected officials and high-level staff can do, because we know that a lot of these approaches make sense.
Okay, so we'll go left, right, left, right.
I have a very specific question about traffic calming through circles.
Roundabouts.
What? Roundabouts. Yeah, thank you. And I've brought it up several times to the engineer at our city, and it says, wait, there's just not enough room in this intersection. We'd have to cut out this giant oak tree, and we just have to put in a light. And then about 2 weeks ago, I was in Berkeley, and there, you know, in the neighborhoods in Berkeley, and the streets are very narrow, and they have roundabouts there. And so my specific question is, what are there standards about that have to do with round? And I've also been in Spain. They have roundabouts in very, you know, narrow streets and small areas. And what can I do to, you know, to try and sell this idea of roundabouts that are inexpensive and can be beautiful in our town?
Heather and Manal, both are itching.
I am not a roundabout expert, but I do know that cities have a lot of discretion about the standards that they use themselves. There's a standards manual that's sort of the best practices that are widely publicized that lead to our 16-foot lanes that are way too big and encourage cars to speed. But cities don't have to go by those standards. And I would really encourage you to contact an elected official in Berkeley and ask them how they got their projects through. I know that it's not always just your city engineer who's going to be a problem. Sometimes it's, you know, fire trucks are concerned about getting through these kinds of things, and there are ways to deal with it. It's not a, it doesn't have to be a you know, a zero-sum game. And I would also point you to the Local Government Commission website has some great examples of traffic calming success stories that I'm not positive they incorporate roundabouts, but they're excellent.
Manal.
In 2002, I was certified as a walkable communities expert. I don't like the term expert, but I was by DHS and Caltrans. And what I would just say is that I found that what's really important is to start off with a walkable communities workshop or some kind of assessment that brings the stakeholders together, community, media, local elected officials, so that you can really, one, learn about the different tools, because what I found is most people think in terms of traffic calming, speed bumps is the first go-to kind of thing in terms of slowing traffic, and there's a whole toolbox of things along the lines of what Robert showed that are available, and just having a group of people go around and walk a survey area that's important to the community can build a lot of consensus in a very brief half-day workshop, learning about the tools and then building some consensus about priorities. And I think that that's a tool, and roundabouts can be considered as people kind of do that. So there's a methodology to that that I think is a good first step, so that there's a little bit more political will and maybe not just your voice kind of saying, I think roundabouts can be great and beautiful, because you're absolutely right. And not only that, there is good data to say that they can reduce the severity of crashes and injuries. So there's some good stuff to support that as an implementation step.
Over here, next.
Yes, I'm Vice Mayor Joyce Starosiak from the City of San Leandro.
It's on.
My question is an issue that's sort of controversial in our city right now, and that's dog parks. Some of the most healthy people in our neighborhoods have dogs, and they walk them. And we want to encourage that because it's more pedestrians on the street. What kinds of situations have you seen regarding specifically dog parks and trying to implement those in some of the communities?
I worked, as I said earlier when I had my comments, I worked for the City of San Diego, and I was the Transportation and Land Use Legislative Specialist there, and we have a place called Dog Beach, which is in Ocean Beach, and the problem that we had was, people just not picking up after themselves, and then we had sort of a group of folks that wanted to have the most aggressive, mean, and vicious dogs they possibly could, and then have the right to allow them to roam freely. So those are the couple of pitfalls, but you know what, right now we know, so you have to have some rules. I would not just open a green space and say dogs run free. You obviously have to have some rules. But you know what, now dog parks are not an exception, they are the rule. We have a new shopping center, Otay Ranch Town Center. There's actually a dog park in the shopping center. And so these are things that really, for the retailers, are something that bring people in. And every store, because it's what they call a lifestyle store, every store has a dog bowl with water out front of it and a place to tie your dog while you go and shop in the Ann Taylor or the Macy's or whatever, So really, these things are very well accepted, but you got to have some rules because people will take advantage, and unfortunately, you don't want to have problems.
As a local resident in South Bay San Diego, I definitely encourage that. You want more feet on the street, mm-hmm. right? But you have to have the infrastructure there, like the baggies and such.
And a strong law.
Yeah. Right. And enforcement has to be in place, when people don't necessarily abide by the rules. But from a crime prevention environmental design standpoint, you want people to be accessing your parks. Mm-hmm. Actually, I was in San Leandro Sunday and Monday because of the Charger Raider game, but I was able to look around and such, and I think it's an awesome strategy because there are safety issues, and one of the things I wanted to interject in this forum was that the common denominator is the public's perception of safety. Safety is the driver. Safety should be the driver. It's not law enforcement's interpretation of what's happening in terms of homicides and assaults. But people will move to your community if it's perceived as safe. If people reclaim areas, that's a perception of safety. And we need to create those types of opportunities mm-hmm. so that whether it be a dog park or an amenitized park in the West Side older stock, then you have a better opportunity for more public good that will result from that.
Right on. Back to the left.
My name is Donna Kurger, and I'm a planning commissioner from the City of San Ramon. And just to my neighbor in San Leandro, we have two dog parks. Dublin has two, City of Dublin has two, and the town of Danville, which is also a neighbor, has two dog parks. And they are highly successful. The people in our communities help patrol and make sure that people pick up, and we have at all of our parks where it's not a dog park, we also have bags. But my question, or I guess, not so much a question, but one of the things that we also do in the City of San Ramon is we bring in partnerships for healthy communities to our school district. Our school district has now removed most of their vending machines and put in healthy food, but also in our nonprofits, the YMCAs and also the child care centers. And when they bring in their proposals to the Planning Commission, we just strongly recommend the fact that, we want to have a healthy community. And part of that healthy community is also bringing in the religious organizations and houses of worship for other things like drugs and drinking. That's all, I think, part of a really good, healthy community. And that's one of the things that we really put our arms around. So great. I just want to suggest those things because sometimes you don't think of child care centers.
Thank you very much.
My name is Joyce. Can you hear me? My name is Joyce Kleiner. I'm a columnist for the Mill Valley Herald. Before I ask you my question, I've got to tell you, if you don't already have a dog park, if you want to see a good dog fight, get people who want a dog park in the same room with people who want a soccer field. So it's not always quite as easy as it sounds. I just wanted to ask you, the problem with planning commissions is that a lot of what they have to do is based on looking at private property. And obviously, you can't, it's very different when you ask a private business, tell a private business what they can sell and so on. It's more complicated. What I'm wondering about is, are there more opportunities for park and rec commissioners to maybe start looking at health and their role as park and rec commissioners to create maybe subgroups to look at providing healthy living, like using their land for farmers markets and so on?
I'll start off by, there's a big role for park and rec, and I think it can be bigger. Park and Rec is the number one partner in joint use agreements with elementary schools, and in places that don't have joint use agreements, Park and Rec is often the logical choice, because the main reason why the schools don't want to open their property is because of worries of maintenance, liability, other associated costs. And Park and Rec agencies, they have their own liability insurance. They have their own staff who can come in and fill in. So they're a great partner in a number of potential areas. Getting healthy vending on park and rec property. We're working with a group in Richmond, California right now that I know Diana Ronda is very familiar with, that's trying to do a lot of that. So I think there's a lot that can be done. I don't know if you guys want to talk, Heather, more about parks and rec.
I'll just add two other things that I think are really good examples of that. One is City of San Francisco, actually this was not an easy win, there was a political fight over this, allowed farmers markets in their parks. And one of the basically definitions that they put into their zoning code in allowing the farmers markets on their parks was that the farmers markets had to accept federal food assistance, the food stamps and WIC. And I think that's a great example of a public agency using their role as a public agency to do the most public good out of the process. And I think that parks are a great place for farmers markets to be, and there's some resources in terms of thinking through what the rules might be and how to make people happy about having a farmers market in their park. The other thing that I would point out is that community gardens are also a great thing to have in parks, and that actually if you have a nonprofit or community-based organization either supporting or leading the management of that, you're actually taking some parks management responsibility off the local government and saving local government money. So I think there are a lot of win-win opportunities with these kinds of partnerships that you describe.
Manel.
Into the conversation, because I think a lot of times with park and rec we tend to think of a specific site, a park site, but one of the things that we know is that nearby access to a park does increase people's physical activity within when it's in, you know, a brief easy walk. And I think there's a couple things that I would just say. One is that I think it's really important for park and rec to look at the entire community, because what we have found is that there are certain communities that disproportionately lack access to safe parks, and then when we go through funding declines like this, the first parks to get locked up or closed are those in lower income communities. So very important to look at disparity and park poverty and how that plays out. And to answer your question, I think that there are a number of creative ways that park spaces can be used, because when they are sort of reclaimed, as Dana has described, they can be really a safe place in the community that can be very free of illicit activities, gang activities, and so on. And so it becomes very important, and not only that, but other kinds of organizations, nonprofits in the community, and so on, can help provide programming or partner to provide programming, because one of the things that is very important is that some people say, well, we have parks, but they're very underutilized. And so there needs to be an outreach process that brings people to those parks. And so I think that those are some additional ways that that partnership could be strengthened.
Great. Sir?
Yeah, Doug Hammerstrom, Mayor of Fort Bragg, and we have two dog parks, and they do encourage walking. And to emphasize the point made by the panel, it was really vital that there was a citizen activist group that was promoting them, that they actually came to exist. My question is kind of a housekeeping issue, and that's, will there be things from this presentation on the League website? They said they were putting things on the website as opposed to publishing them, and in particular, contact information for the presenters, if you're willing to be resources, and in the program, the fourth speaker wasn't listed, and I wanted to get her name.
Steve, you want to answer most of that? And as for the fourth speaker, you can come and ask her name and how to spell it, or I'm happy to tell you.
I made a PowerPoint for this talk so I can ask Steve to put that on the web, and you can have that, and I'll have my contact information.
And I would just say that I get a lot of calls from folks in cities, not only in California, but all over the country, about some of the things we've done because of the websites and just the city of Chula Vista being highlighted. And yeah. My assistant is always willing to get whatever information together and help out anybody we possibly can. So we'd love to do that. We really appreciate you contacting us as well.
Hi, I'm Jan Hale-Marks, and I'm on the City Council of San Luis Obispo. We were the first city in the whole world to ban smoking, and we also gave... We also, at the same year, which was in the 70s, banned fast food drive-through restaurants, and we still don't have any. Of course, people are really mad about not having an In-N-Out burger, but outside of that, and they won't budge. But anyway, so I'd say go look at the San Luis Obispo, slowcity.org, if anybody wants to see what the ordinances are there. We have a tremendously dedicated wellness community, local food, locavores, farmers market, and all that. So it's really a very motivated community. At least half of it is. And this is a permanent residence, okay? The other half of the people who live in our city are mostly renters. They're mostly students. And they're wonderful, bright, loved young people who show up at our doorstep this time of year, and the first week they're there, this year so far it hasn't happened. Last year there was a fatality right off a wonderful young man at 18 died as alcohol poisoning. The fraternity has been banned. The parties in our neighborhoods, especially featuring alcohol, and just the general level of drunkenness and public disrespect is going up every year. And we're in a situation where we've had to cut two neighborhood patrol officers because of the budget. Hmm. And just listening to you, I was thinking about, so we have a quite unusual community, how to reach young people about excessive use of alcohol, how to reach people who are strangers to your community, who look at it really as a place like, okay, I'm not being supervised, mom and dad will never know. And then, our firefighters have to pick up drunken people. Often they've soiled themselves on the street. And, it's just really a huge drag on our community. So I wonder what kind of health-related resources there might be for college towns, you know?
Well, I mean, there are a couple of things that cities can do related to alcohol availability. And so, you know, if you first have to use the conditional use permit process to eliminate new opportunities for new groups to come in, particularly if SLO has a prevalence in a particular area.
Plus, well, and the other thing,
do you have a social host ordinance program?
Yeah, we just beefed it up.
Okay, and that's something, you know, that obviously can help as well, but...
Is this strictly indoor drinking, or is it outdoor drinking that's a problem also?
Well, it starts indoors, and
then it pours outdoors,
Last night, I live quite close to Cal Poly. My husband is a professor there. I like living in a student neighborhood all the time. Last night after our city council meeting went till 12:30, we were talking about traffic, of course.
Yeah, right.
So it went to 12:30, and so I'm driving home, and there's two residences on our block that were having simultaneous parties, and the street was completely blocked with people who were drinking. And I was going to call the police and rat on them, but then I saw that on the other side of the crowd there was one of our police officers trying to break it up, you know.
Yeah.
So there's that. But then I'm just wondering about the whole health issue, the health aspect of educating these people, because alcoholism usually starts when you are 18 and go off to college. And I'm just, like I said, it's a growing problem for our community. I don't quite know how to bridge the gap between our resident community that's so gung-ho for all of this wellness stuff and the students who are just, you know, in our faces.
Yeah, I think we can talk more about that, but I think there's a big role for Cal Poly as well. I imagine you've probably partnered with them in their student orientation procedures, because I went to a college in Canada where that was a big issue, and that's been turned around over the last 20 years through partnerships between the city, the police, and the university in really changing around the orientation week has totally been changed around. So I think there's a lot that can be done.
And not related to your question, but your initial comment about the being the first city to have, or the fast food policy, I just wanted to highlight that our organization, Prevention Institute, has developed a local policy database that basically catalogs all the healthy eating active community policies that have been passed in California, and includes where they've been passed. The San Luis Obispo one is one that's there, and it also has the actual policy language, when it was adopted, and how it is linked to healthy eating in active communities. So that's a resource I'd like people to be aware of. And Linda Schack, who I mentioned earlier, is the developer of that and maintainer of that site. And so if there are any local policies that you have in your community, that city, county policies to support that, we'd like to make sure that that's featured in the database so it can be a growing repository for each of you.
Tell them the name of the database.
It's called the Enact Local Policy Database, E-N-A-C-T.
Yeah. And so you might be able to find some useful. So I'll happy to talk to you afterwards. Last question, please. Oh, I see two. Steve, do we have time for two questions? Yes, that's a yes. Yeah, so.
First of all, I'd like to say I think this is the best workshop I've been to at a League of Cities conference. It's very relevant to the work that we're doing. So, yeah, congrats to all of you. I'm Mayor Pro Tem for the city of Maywood, which is a small city in southeast Los Angeles. It's an extremely contaminated, polluted area. We have the highest rate of asthma along with our neighboring city of Huntington Park. And it's just very difficult because actually in our community, it is a Latino working class community that is extremely active. So maybe that's just a problem you're having in Chula Vista. But there's so much work going on there. And, you know, we have created a community cumulative impacts commission to deal with some of the problems that are arising around our community. But we have issues where we have a neighboring city which emits a great deal of pollution. We're right by the 710 freeway. We're right by rail yards. So it's almost like as much as we do, we still have all of these factors that are affecting us. And you know, we just started building two new parks and we got funding for them. But because of the state budget crisis now, those funds are frozen. So there are our parks, you know, just empty lots with grass on them that's dying, and we don't have any funds. And so it's really refreshing to hear that, you know, some of the transportation funds, we might be able to use them to build walkable, bikeable communities. So that's an idea, but can you give me more ideas as to what we can do to hold us over during this tough economic time? Because we're making great strides, but I don't want it to be cut off because of all the stuff going on in Sacramento.
So this is not a panacea, but I think it's even more important in these times for city agencies and county agencies to find out how to work together to maximize their resources. There's a, I don't know if you have a redevelopment agency and what it's doing and what it's focusing on. And I know redevelopment agencies are getting some of their money clawed back, but potential partnerships with them. I've heard in Oakland from the redevelopment agency director how this, some of the schools that have ground that they want to build parks on, they don't have the fund and the ground is going fallow. They're seeding that through 99-year leases to the redevelopment agency. The redevelopment agency is building park facilities and then entering into joint use agreements with the schools so the schools can have access as well as the community. That's just creative use of resources. The redevelopment agency can't just give money or give the facility to the school because then the state would cut the amount of money they give back to the school one-to-one. So it's just, I mean, it's really difficult in this time, but I think the opportunities is sort of forcing us to think about how public agencies can work together to fulfill their mission. Yeah. You guys have other?
Well, I was just going to say, I think with the attention to climate change right now, that's a really important time to bring maybe in a 4 or 5 city collaborative the attention to the issue of asthma, because from a health perspective, obviously, asthma is a problem, but also it keeps people from getting physical activity. And I think that with the Strategic Growth Council and the CARB looking at the state level at how to create criteria at the local level, you know, that and funding some work at the local level to address reductions in vehicle miles traveled and the other kinds of emissions issue that you're talking about might be very important to sort of elevate the visibility of the issues that you're facing with your galvanized community. One of the things that I found in going to the Strategic Growth Council meetings up in Sacramento, which is a, you know, interagency collaborative, which includes business, transportation, housing, health, natural resources, Office of Planning and Research, Steve, who's the fifth one? EPA, Cal EPA, they are there, and there's the public participation, I think, is pretty poor. And I think when they hear from people that are in cities actually facing these, and if you could somehow get community members up there in their next meeting, which is planned for October 13th, I think making some very strong statements about we need to see this stuff happen concretely because it's really affecting us. And then the other thing I would just say for Maywood is really learning about what Long Beach has done. They've done a lot of great stuff around the port, and I know you're very affected by that. But what we run the risk of in a place like Maywood because of the income levels is that they get solved in other places and not there. And so...
Yeah, I think it's time to start reaching out to different stakeholder groups in the community, medical community, faith community, because obviously your community is being overlooked. And you need to seek alliances with other groups so that they are starting to pay attention with what's going on in your community. I work outside of work. I work and support the work of the Environmental Health Coalition in Westside National City. And we've had these issues of environmental toxins and crazy zoning strategies where you put like auto body paint shops next to residential areas next to, and you're like, how did this happen? You know? And so you attack the area specific plan process, but then you also, they expect to hear the outcry from you because of your position, but when they start hearing different groups talking to the issues, then people start hearing. And then, again, forming your alliances at the county and state levels, whatever you could do in order to shine the light on your community. I have a colleague in HEAC Baldwin Park, and they have a neighboring community that is going to have a dump site. and look at those environmental impacts that's going to have on Baldwin Park and its redevelopment plans. And so it's really about reaching out to those groups and developing those partnerships.
I'd like all of your cards so we can strategize.
No problem. Sir, final question.
My name is Shane Brenton. I'm a council member from the city of Arcata. And my question regards trying to find a way to tie new revenue sources to disincentivizing unhealthy behaviors. I know that San Francisco's really been leading the way in kind of exploring how much we can use fees on things like cigarettes, alcohol, and maybe even soft drinks. I recently was in touch with Supervisor John Avalos from San Francisco, and he's working on something called an alcohol mitigation fee. But I haven't been able to find a lot of other resources on this sort of new kind of innovative way of using fees on these sorts of products. And I wondered if you knew of any resources, legal resources in particular, that might be helpful for cities.
Yeah, on our website, Public Health Law and Policy, actually it's phlpnet.org, but it's on our cards if you get a card. We have a nexus study for soda, sweetened beverages, and fees. I will say this is the advice, and I'm not a fees expert, but what I've been drilled into my head by the lawyers that I work with is you need to be prepared to defend on these fees because they are new strategies. Not to say that, you know,
put that in English when you say you need to be prepared
you
to
need
defend.
To have money for lawyers.
You will be sued.
You might get sued. Right. So, now, that doesn't mean that I think that's not supposed to be a chilling statement to keep communities from being innovative. It's just so they can't go in with their eyes open and they know what they're getting into.
Yeah, and then make sure that you write the ordinance in such a way so that it's legally defensible.
Right, exactly. Get good legal.
We have a lot of experience with that. I think we're one of the only cities with a law against the U.S. Patriot Act. So
there you go.
The city of Arcata is ready to defend. We just want to know that. Yeah. The resources are out there to support this kind of.
Well, and then there are a lot of movements going on in that regard. The other thing also is, you know, those we talked about dog parks, and you know, a lot of cities don't have money for the little bags, so everybody brings those dreaded plastic bags from the grocery store. We're also looking at a fee on those that will help us with respect to litter cleanup in our neighborhoods.
And you guys have a really active public health department in Humboldt County, so they could potentially partner with you on some of these things.
I would just say that there is a statewide discussion really currently underway around the soda fee, and I think that what we do know is that localities can do taxes and fees, and I think one important learning from the tobacco work is that the local work really became the bubble-up factor that made statewide and then federal legislation possible. So I think what's very important is that as localities consider this, not just as thinking of it as a single win for or loss or, you know, for the locality, but as part of a broader strategy and movement mm-hmm. to bubble up towards state and national, you know, change around this issue. And I think what's very important is that we are in a unique time with the economy down and we're all looking for sources of revenue and attention to diabetes and obesity and the health impacts is at an all-time high. Does that create sort of the perfect storm that would make something that was otherwise politically kind of unfeasible now open up a window for that? And so I think we should think about the number of locales that are thinking about this coming together, strategizing a little bit together, so it's not just you in your you know, own community, but you as part of a larger strategy.
Well, and you know, the California Center for Public Health Advocacy is really doing a lot of leadership work on this, so you know, we can just point you again to the same folks we've been talking about, you know, Charlotte and Cheska in the back, who are doing a lot of this kind of statewide organizing.
Great.
Yeah. Sorry.
Excuse
this
me.
This is one. I don't have this opportunity a lot, but
No.
Local control. I think that there's so much innovation in this room, and if I were in your seat, I wouldn't allow any of this stuff to exist in my community. And just look at the people, just look at the areas and parts of our state that are actually thriving, that have everything that we want. Mm-hmm. Why can't we have it in our own places? And so, you know, I would be selfish myself to create the type of quality of life and environment for my city if I had that power and if I had that opportunity. And so that, and I'd stay close to the city attorney and try to build champions and, you know, try to express this vision as an elected official and get allies in the higher level staff in order to really foster the vision, cultivate it, so that people can, you know, revitalize communities in a real way and not just do city business.
Well, and then I just have one last thing, because we all fall upon this. When we're having a discussion within our own respective boards and we talk about maybe some, you know, some policy issue that will affect business, and typically you have people on your board, whether it's a council or, you know, a board of some sort, and they say, well, you know, we need to find out what the businesses think about this. And they say, let's go talk to the city, you know, the Chamber of Commerce. Don't talk to the Chamber of Commerce. Because 9 times out of 10, they will tell you, no, we're not going to do that. Go find the businesses that will be directly affected, the grocery stores, the mom-and-pop stores, the folks that are doing it every day on the street. And you know what? Oftentimes, surprisingly, they have good ideas. They have a buy-in because they understand that that's what people want. And so, you know, I mean, it's just like going to the building industry, and all of us that are city officials always deal with the building industry, you know, and they always say, you can't do this, this, and this. But guess what? The individual builders are doing all that because they want to sell their product. So I'm just saying, you know what, you got to go down to the street level, because those are the stakeholders, not the industry associations, because they'll never tell you exactly, you know, how it is. Thank you.
So hold on. There's one more question that I've just seen, but Steve just put this in my hand. I want to make sure everyone stops at the back table, because there are a number of resources. My organization, Planning for Healthy Places, we've put forward a whole sort of bullet point set of steps that you can take as a local elected official. And there's this phenomenal Healthy Neighborhoods, Partners, and Resources, which has been created by ILG. And so if you want to know how to get in contact with the different organizations that are here and others that can help you, the Healthy Eating, Active Living Cities campaign from the California Center for Public Health Advocacy, Planning for Healthy Places, Strategic Alliance, Center for Civic Partnership, and on. So all that is available there. So please make sure you don't leave empty-handed. And one more question has popped up, and I'm serious. This is the last question.
My name is Ruby Dhaliwal. I'm a mid-city of San Joaquin, and I think the council member was right on the count. I'm also a grocer. I have a corner store in my community, and we don't offer very healthy choices to our community member. As a businessman, I like to, you know, have the other way around. But we basically, what the demand is that post the spies. To have a healthy choice, we have to have a distribution line and the whole infrastructure to support it.
Yep.
I was wondering if the mandate that you guys did in your community to offer healthier choices, was it backed up by some distributor who was actually going to the groceries? And also a question for the resources person, is there any incentives available for business people to push that line of product?
Well, first of all, with respect to the changes that we made in our policy, you know, we made unilateral decisions. I mean, we felt that basically if somebody, you know, wanted to purchase some food that really wasn't healthy, they're going to have to do it somewhere else. I mean, that's just basically the way that we felt. And it's actually been, we've heard back from the vendor who initially was not very supportive of our policy decision and said, you know, we're actually haven't seen any change in the sales. They tend to be the same. The other thing is they're hungry. You know what I mean? And so I think that, you know, I think that's the fallacy that, and again, that's like going back to the industry associations and asking what they think. So the other thing is that it really is important to have that resource in the community, like a HEAC or a HEAL or somebody that's working to educate folks on what is good for them and how they can change their lifestyle. Because once they're educated, believe me, nobody wants to die early. Nobody wants to get sick. And once people understand what they need to do, they go to their grocery stores and they look for those kinds of foods. And if they're not there, then obviously they're not going to buy them. But if they are there, they are going to buy them. Well, what I'm seeing and talking to some of the retailers, both small and large, is that we can educate and basically help these retailers sell those kinds of foods, they'll supply them.
I don't know if your store is WIC certified, but there are changes coming in the federal WIC food package, which will enable that that money to be spent on fruit, vegetables, and other healthy food. And if you are WIC certified, that's going to give you a whole new access to a whole new market for fresh and healthy foods that hasn't existed up until now. So I'd encourage you to get WIC certified if you aren't already.
I would point you to an excellent resource, which is the Healthy Corner Stores Network. And I'm very sympathetic to this problem. This is a problem of many small store owners where they don't have the infrastructure, as you described, to really carry produce. And as a business owner, they may not have access to either a distributor who will distribute, you know, small amounts of fresh produce to them at a reasonable cost, or even necessarily, you know, the ability to get a loan to put that infrastructure in, or the kind of technical expertise of how to build that into your business plan over the long term. I feel like store owners in this area are actually great advocates, and the Healthy Corner Stores Network has examples of a few public initiatives from around the country that have actually done a whole combination of things. They've offered store owners low-cost loans or free infrastructure, and especially infrastructure that is energy efficient, which we know that for small stores and grocery stores, actually energy is often their huge cost as when you start adding produce and things in. And then they'll also do community education and social marketing around the stores where they're doing food demonstrations or cooking demonstrations in the store to kind of educate customers about what, you know, the new products might be, as well as business training and development for the store owners so that they understand how to make money off of a really different kind of line of products. So the Healthy Corner Stores Network is great for this, and I would just encourage you to not only participate in the network or to seek out resources there, but to go to your community and say, hey, if we have a small business development program, my business should be eligible for it, and it should be able to help me develop as a healthy business owner.
Okay, that's it. Thank you all. And thank you to a great panel.